This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our guest, Mike White, co-created the HBO series Enlightened with Laura Dern. He also wrote all the episodes, directed a few, and is one of the show's stars. Earlier this month, HBO presented the second season finale of Enlightened, which walks the line between comedy and drama. Season 1 began with Laura Dern's character of Amy returning home after a stay in rehab, where she had learned to meditate and get in touch with what she describes as her higher self. When she returned to work, she had to accept a demotion. Separated from her husband and living in her mother's suburban home, her life felt empty. Throughout season 1, it was difficult for Amy to stay in touch with her higher self, but she still believed she could change. In season 2, after being less than successful at changing herself, she set out to make an impact on the world and lead a bigger life. She decided to become a whistleblower at the corporation where she works, and tried to convince her shy, inhibited office mate, Tyler, played by Mike White, to use his IT expertise to help. Here's a scene from early in season 2, in which Amy is telling Tyler that she's used his password to hack into corporate email accounts, looking for incriminating evidence to bring down the corporation.
Okay, so I started in Damon's accounts, right? And then I just, like, went into every email I could open, all the top execs, and, like, we knew they were plunderers. Just screwing their workers, covering up their dirty dumping. That's not the sickest part. They don't care, Tyler. They don't care. They're hurting people, and they know it, and it's a game to them. They make jokes about it in these emails. When this comes out, we're talking about at least 100 class action lawsuits.
What do you mean when it all comes out? How's it going to come out?
There's this guy, Jeff Blender. He's at the LA Times. He writes these corporate exposés. He is the perfect journalist for this.
Oh, my God. Please just don't go back in there with my password. They will trace it back to me.
Tyler, I have to go back in. I don't have a hard copy. I couldn't get the printer to work. You know, it always jams up. I need your help.
No. I gave you that password in a moment of weakness. I'm not getting any deeper into this.
Don't you feel an obligation? People are living under the illusion that the American dream is working for them. And it's rigged by the guys at the tippy top.
Well, I may not be at the top, but I'm happy.
No, you're not. You're miserable. You're a mole. You're paralyzed.
Well, I'm changing. I just joined the company gym, and I got a discount because of my employee badge, and I'm going to work out more. And my aunt died, and I just found out I got her timeshare, so I'm going to go to the Bahamas for 2 weeks a year. So maybe I'm a mole, but I'm a happy mole, and I don't want to lose what little I have, okay?
You've already lost it. They're shutting us down.
And what they're shutting down is the department that the Laura Dern character and the Mike White character work in. Mike White, welcome back to Fresh Air. It is so great to have you again. I really loved this season.
Oh, awesome.
So this season was different from the first. The first was focused on Laura Dern's character coming back home and back to work after a stay in rehab where she learned how to meditate. And she really tried to be her better self. But it's hard to be her better self when she's back in the world again. The new season, she's working to change the world through bringing down her corporation. How did you decide to take it in that direction?
Well, the truth was that the original pitch to HBO was that it would get to that whistleblower place in the first season. But as I started writing it, I realized there was like kind of nooks and crannies of her life that I wanted to explore, and I don't know, I got more interested in the digressions than the overall like meta plot. And so as I got into it, I was like, we're not going to be able to get to this here. And so it became a two-seasoner instead of one season.
So in the second season, Amy thinks that in order to get access to corporate emails that can help blow the whistle on what the corporation's doing wrong and help bring, you know, charges against the CEO, she asked your character, Tyler, who, you know, knows a lot about IT, to basically break into the hard drive of the CEO's assistant, who's played by Molly Shannon. And in order to do that, she wants you to kind of, you know, maybe go out on a date with her and pretend like you're really interested in her. But the thing is, you get really interested in her, and you do go out on a date with her, and she gets interested in you. And just as you're finally having, like, a woman in your life, and you're finally truly connecting to somebody, you're also feeling so guilty about it because you know that even though it's not your agenda, you're being deployed as part of an agenda and that she's going to get hurt. So I'd like to play a clip from the scene in which you are together at your home for the first time, you and the Molly Shannon character. And you're both very shy. She's very worried about getting hurt because she's been hurt before. And so you're sitting on the living room couch and, you know, starting to get to know each other a little bit. It's a little bit awkward. And you're exchanging your first kiss.
Do you want to spend the night?
You know, you don't really look me in the eye that much.
Sorry.
Look, I just don't want to get hurt, okay? I'm just at the age where I don't want to go through all that, you know? I don't have expectations. I don't care, whatever. But I just don't want to deal with a jerk or someone who's fake or mean, you know? You seem sad and sweet, and I like that. But are you? Are you sweet?
I think so.
I'm just too old to get kicked in the face, you know?
Well, it's not my plan.
That's not your plan.
I love that scene because, like, you're not, your character isn't fake and mean, but he's now in the position of inadvertently being fake. And she's so vulnerable in the scene. She's so good, Molly Shannon. You know,
I can't believe you played the sounds of us kissing.
I did that for a reason.
Like, this is killing me.
I did that for a reason.
Smacking of the lips.
No, you know, I'm always interested. It seems to me now, I did that for a reason. It seems to me now that in the movies, kisses are mic'd more closely than they've ever been before. And you actually hear the sound of the kissing. And there's like different kinds of sounds for the different kisses. And in this case, it was like short staccato chirp kisses. Like... And I was wondering, like, so when you wrote that scene, did you describe how the kisses would sound? Did you, when you talked to Molly Shannon about that scene, did you agree on, like, what the percussive qualities of the kiss would be? The tonal and percussive qualities.
It was built to be awkward in so many ways. I mean, the characters would clearly be awkward. But, you know, Molly and I are really good friends and have been friends for a long time. And I don't know, the idea of, like, suddenly kissing her. I just felt, you know, obviously Tyler's not, you know, a sexual dynamo. He has probably had very limited sexual experience, and sounds like she has too. So, you know, that kind of like junior high kiss seemed like the way to go with that.
Yeah, and it said to me too, like, they were afraid to have a sustained kiss. Like, short kisses were safer, and we could see, like, oh, do we want to do a second kiss?
Right.
A third?
Right.
Okay, settling in. Fourth kiss.
Anyway, yes, Terry, what's your question?
Well, that kind of was the question. And choreographing it, too, like making sure that it looked authentic but really uncomfortable.
Right.
And uncertain.
Well, I don't know. I think we were just kind of, I don't know, we were just in character and did it. There wasn't really a lot of discussion beforehand about how it would go, but it seemed right, at least to the director, you know, at the time. It felt like that was the right approach.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mike White. He's the creator of the HBO series Enlightened, and he wrote all the episodes and directed many of them and is also the co-star. In the second season, the character of Amy, played by Laura Dern, decides to try to take down the corporation that she works for because she knows that they're a polluter. She suspects they're guilty of other things too, and she wants to be an agent of change and change the world through changing this company. And also, she just wants a different life. She's tired of being a nobody. She's tired of being bored and of leading a boring life. Since you had to write from the perspective of somebody who wants to be a whistleblower, what did you do in preparation for that? Did you talk to anybody who'd been it, or, you know, read one of those many whistleblower memoirs that have been published?
Well, I have. I mean, over the years, you know, that's something that's interesting to me. But I didn't really do a lot of, like, in-depth research. I mean, Amy is kind of flying blind, so it's not like –
exactly,
it's a little
yeah.
bit like the layman's, like, entry into what that is. So, like, I tried to get some of the sort of, like, more plotty machinations right. Like, how would that actually work? But as far as – you know, the thing that I like about Amy as a character and why I feel like she's worthy of a show is that – she is, and I think that this is something that you could apply to some whistleblowers, you know, not all. There is a righteous cause, but there is also, you know, somebody who potentially has like a Joan of Arc complex, or, you know, somebody who has a little bit of delusions of grandeur. You know, it's like somebody wrote online, like, why doesn't Amy just volunteer at a local charity if she wants to feel good? And it was a funny question because I was like, that would never be enough for her. Like, you know, she wants big change because she wants to be a big character and a big drama. And it's what makes her a flawed character, but it also maybe amusing, but also it's part and parcel with why she wants to be a whistleblower, because she wants to, like, burn it down.
And she's so naive, though. She doesn't even know much about the issues that she wants to bring to the forefront. She's just naive in every way. And through the journalist who she's leaking these corporate emails to, she, you know, gets exposed to Twitter, and she sees, like, he's got a lot of followers, and she goes to, like, a book party, and the author has a lot of followers on Twitter, so she decides she needs to be on Twitter, and she goes around telling people, like, you have to follow me on Twitter, because, you know, I think she's up to, like, 14 followers by the end of the episode after having tapped, like, everybody that she knows. And she doesn't even know the language for him, and she wants to twit. But the ending of the episode is so wonderful, because it's a voiceover, and she's thinking about how now she's really part of that, you know, revolution where we're all interconnected through social media and being online. And so what I want to do is play that voiceover that ends the episode, and then I'm going to ask you to tell us what we've actually been watching as we've listened to the voiceover. So here's the voiceover. Okay. This is Laura Dern.
I have joined the new world. I learn its language. Clicking and flashing and pinging. I read its signs. Electric. Invisible. In this world, the meek like me will finally rise. And the confused will become certain. And the powerful will be laid low. And we will all unite in a single current of compassion and action. The new world. It is so close. You can hear its angels buzzing. It is here. Follow me. Follow me.
That's Laura Dern in a voiceover from Enlightened, the series created by my guest Mike White, who also wrote all the episodes and co-stars in it. So as we hear her say that everyone will unite in a single current of compassion and action through the internet, Mike White, what are we actually seeing happening on screen?
Well, you're starting with seeing a bunch of different characters that we know either on their phones or online. And then by the end, you're at this Starbucks where everybody is, you know, all at their computers and at their smartphones. And they're, you know, most of them are just, you know, scrolling through pictures of somebody's vacation or, you know, on some gossip site. And they all slightly have their mouths agape or, you know, half zoning off. And, you know, to me, it's like, you know, yeah, it gets into my whole anxiety about technology and social media and all of that.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a scene, like the scene in the Starbucks. Everybody, the cafe is filled, but no one is talking to each other. Everybody's just on their personal device looking at a screen. So,
right.
But the Laura Dern character feels so, she feels this so deeply, even though it's kind of delusional. And it's not all delusional, because there's so much that the internet and social media have done. But to hear her feel something so deeply and to at the same time see how kind of delusional it is so interesting.
Well, to me, it's, I mean, I like that you played that clip, because when I saw it, when we finally executed it, I was like, well, this kind of encapsulates all of the weird tone of the show and why the show is both, like, I guess, challenging for an audience and certainly challenging to know how to sell it. But it's also what I am proud of in a sense, because it's funny, because I have a friend who's like a big social, like Twitter, and he brought me on his podcast show and he had read that completely straight and was like, this is what I've been trying to tell everybody. Like, this is, and he never saw that, like, the sort of like a sardonic aspect of it and that then others see it completely as this, as a critique of, you know, technology or that. And the fact that it could be open enough to contain both readings, mm-hmm. is a pleasure, as at least as a writer for me. And I feel like that's Amy, that Amy is somebody who has these great, you know, her intentions are great, and it is very, the idealism is beautiful to me. At the same time, like, in reality, how that actually works itself out is always a little bit more, a little less than or something.
So Amy so much, you know, the Laura Dern character so much wants to kind of connect to a larger world, a bigger world, a world with, like, issues and activism. And part of the reason why she's a whistleblower is as a way of entering through the door to a more interesting world. And I'm wondering what it was like for you when you tried to start establishing yourself as a writer and to get into that world, to get into the world of movies and TV shows, and to have, you know, a voice as a writer.
Well, I think, I mean, that's interesting. I do, I relate to Amy in that way. I remember I grew up in Pasadena in a very kind of homogenous, kind of suburban existence. And then I went to college at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. And there were all these kind of hipster New York kids who were so cultured and had so much, you know, like, knew all the references and, like, already had their look down. And I have always felt like, I don't know, I missed the first day of French class, and, like, I started the second day and I was like, what did they teach on the first day? Because it felt like, I was like, how did, and that's how I always had felt about this certain kind of, these people who all, you know, I don't know, I felt like I was always fighting to find like-minded people, or, you know, I had to go to the library and, you know, look up, you know, like, I don't know, it was kind of like I had to self-teach myself certain things and learn about culture in a way, because it wasn't so accessible in a sense.
The last time you were on the show, during season one of Enlightened, we talked about how Amy's experiences in rehab and then her difficult re-entry into the world of her home and her neighborhood and her office, you know, and the difficulty of that was based in part on your experience after having this really big anxiety attack because of something that happened at work on the TV series that you were working on. And so, as I recall, you basically taken to, like, a mental hospital where you thought, like, I don't really belong here. It's like work-related anxiety. I'm not, you know, I'm not, like, schizophrenic or mentally ill or anything. But that's when you started reading Buddhism, or at least when you started reading it, like, very seriously. And I'm wondering, are you still reading that? Are you still trying to hold on to something of that calm place that you know exists that's so hard to find when you're stressed out and working on deadline?
Yeah, I mean, I do. And honestly, I feel like that experience and reading those things have changed me. And I feel like there's something about what those books did for me that I guess, you know, was what I'm trying to do on Enlightened in a sense, which is trying to It's like the hope is, you know, it's like at some point you're like, okay, my mind's been blown. It's like, how do I stitch it back together? You know, it's like, how do I create something that is, it's a cliche, it's a new age cliche, but like, be the change you want to see. It's like, how do I create the things that I want to see, and how can you make something that is compassionate and potentially can be healing to someone? Or, you know, they talk about in Buddhism, like there's Tonglen practice, which is like someone in, you know, breathing in like the suffering of either yourself or others, and then breathing out like a kind of hopefulness. And, you know, you can see art or fiction or whatever being a version of that, where you try to create something that's hopeful, but that also recognizes pain, you know? It doesn't run from the pain. It, like, it actually acknowledges it. Because I feel like so much of entertainment now is so much about distraction and, you know, like a bombarding of, you know, it's like it's all light and noise. And, you know, for me, after having that experience, a lot of that stuff feels very empty or something, or it just feels like it's, you know, adding to this sense of anxiety that you get in life, because there's just so much coming at you. And, you know, whether I've succeeded in that or not, I feel like there is an impulse there that I feel like, you know, even if Enlightened fails, I don't want to, you know, walk away from what I'm trying to, I guess, achieve, which is like try to make something that is, you know, a little bit more maybe contemplative or a little slowed down and a little bit more about like, how do we live, as opposed to just, you know, like something that's about distracting you from those questions.
Well, I think you just articulated why I like the series. Yeah.
Can I just say one thing is that when, you know, years ago I was on your show for The Amazing Race, and the head of HBO happened to be listening that night and told, you know, the people that worked with me, you know, it's like, you know, we should do a Mike White show. Something I said in that thing made him want to be in business with me. And out of that was born
really?
Enlightened.
Wow.
So it's very ironic. That
makes
like,
me so happy because I like the series so much.
Oh, awesome. But yeah, so thank you for Enlightened, Terry.
Oh, gosh. Wow. Oh, wow, you've made my day.
Mike White is the co-creator and co-star of HBO's Enlightened. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. David Bowie has a new album, his first new studio album in nearly a decade. It's called The Next Day. Rock critic Ken Tucker says Bowie's new music displays a youthful energy and inventiveness.
The cover of David Bowie's new album, The Next Day, is actually the cover of Bowie's 1977 album, Heroes, with a white square placed over the singer's face. It's a brilliantly simple yet shrewd piece of appropriated art, a gesture announcing that Bowie will not try to break with his past, but instead will transmute it, refract it, and, if he's lucky, deepen it. Because depth is something David Bowie has usually, often wisely, resisted. In taking on over the decades different costumes and guises, Ziggy Stardust, the Thin White Duke, and in gliding across the surface of genres such as glam rock, hard rock, and disco, Bowie has proven a surprisingly durable artist. He's someone whose best songs allow him to make emotional, even moving music without becoming maudlin or melodramatic or, heaven forbid, sentimental. Stars are never sleeping.
Behind the shades.
Stars Are Out Tonight, which proceeds from the title pun to suggest that stars, celebrities, haunt the lives of us ordinary folk, and that they are just as jealous of our lives as some of us are of theirs. The video for this song, co-starring Bowie and Tilda Swinton, finds them playing a happily aging couple who grocery shop and chuckle unironically at TV sitcoms, even as their mundane activities are observed by young, glamorous people literally dying for such contentment. The music of The Stars Are Out Tonight is all guitar and drum-driven urgency, with Bowie yelling with deliberate hoarseness over the instruments, his voice a metaphor for the exhausted dread contained in the lyric. By contrast, listen to the lovely croon he uses on this song, Where Are We Now?
Had to get the train from Potsdamer Platz. You never knew that I could do that, just walking the day. Sitting in the jungle, I remember the Strasbourg. A man lost in time near Cardiff, just walking the dead.
Where Are We Now evokes life in Berlin, a reminder that the album itself reunites Bowie with producer Tony Visconti, with whom Bowie made his so-called Berlin trilogy of albums, Low, Heroes, and Lodger. But Bowie and Visconti don't merely reconnect with some of the sounds of that late 70s period, extending even to the use of some familiar Bowie musicians, such as guitarist Earl Slick. No, they also acknowledge other albums, including what I consider Bowie's finest, Station to Station, and other producers who've helped Bowie's evolution, most notably Nile Rodgers, who guided the star through one of his best albums, Let's Dance. You can hear this confluence of influences in a jittery, hammering song such as Love Is Lost.
It's the darkest hour, you're 22.
Wave goodbye to the life without pain, Bowie sings there, and in a song that offers a mock hymn to that ceaseless modern quest for the new, it's also an acknowledgement of the physical pain of aging, as well as romantic agony. In general, I find the structure of The Next Day significant, because it plays like a collection of discrete singles, songs each in a different style, genre, mood, very much in the current mode of consuming music, downloading one hit or potential hit at a time. Yet the music also coheres as an album in the classic rock sense, a unified statement that can be listened to at full length to tell a story about one man's progression through innocence, experience, arrogance, cynicism, doubt, redemption, and inspiration. Yes, that's overstating it a bit, but not much. Yes, some of these steps falter in melody or in sustaining the desired effect. But in general, The Next Day is a thriller, not merely a return to form. Partly because David Bowie never took one form to begin with. This is his now continuing contribution to pop music, the notion that restlessness and melancholy can yield more pleasure than anyone might reasonably expect.
Ken Tucker is Fresh Air's pop music critic. He reviewed David Bowie's new album, The Next Day. You'll find a music video for Bowie's new song, The Stars Are Out Tonight, which features the actress Tilda Swinton, on our website. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Valentine told me who's to go.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. Mike Piazza had a career in baseball's big leagues that was as unlikely as it was accomplished. He was drafted in the 62nd round by the Los Angeles Dodgers in 1988, mostly because Piazza's father was an old friend of Dodgers manager Tommy Lasorda. Nobody in the organization expected Piazza to amount to much. But by the time he hung up his cleats in 2007, he had numbers that may well put him in the Hall of Fame. He was a 12-time All-Star who had a lifetime batting average of .308 and hit 427 home runs, the most ever by a catcher. He spent nearly all of his career in the nation's two biggest media markets, L.A. and New York, and made plenty of headlines. Sometimes bickering with fellow players, being outed as gay even though he isn't, and engaging in an epic on-field confrontation with Yankees pitcher Roger Clemens. Piazza has a new memoir called Long Shot. He spoke recently with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Mike Piazza, welcome to Fresh Air. I think it was Malcolm Gladwell who said that to master something difficult, you need to put in 10,000 hours of practice. And reading your book, it sounds like you might have put in that many by the third grade. How did you practice at home?
Well, like most kids, typically I started in Little League, you know, about 7 years old. And my father, who was not able to play baseball but was a baseball fanatic, I mean, he was extremely enthusiastic about the game. He loved Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams and all the players of the golden era. And when I was about 11, he constructed a backyard hitting cage, a batting cage with a machine, automatic feeder. So I was able to go out there many, many days in all types of weather, tirelessly hit, you know, again and again, hit curveballs, hit different types of pitches. The machine was able to do that, and just became sort of completely dedicated my early, you know, childhood and even into my teenage years to hitting a baseball.
You were unique also in that your dad had this longtime friendship with Tommy Lasorda. They came from the same area outside of Philly.
Yes.
Lasorda, of course, the legendary manager of the Dodgers. And so you had contact with big league baseball at an early age, right? You were a bat boy for the Dodgers when
Yes.
they were in Philly?
Yeah, there was a funny story when I first went to a Dodgers game at Vet Stadium, and my dad was yelling at Tommy, and when they were kids in Norristown, they always took on the names of their favorite ballplayers, and Tommy's favorite ballplayer was Van Lingo Mungo, I think, and so my dad was yelling at him, "Hey, Mungo, hey, Mungo," and he turned around and started joshing with my dad over the rail, and they hugged, and I remember this kid going, "Wow, you know, my dad knows the coach of the team." He was coaching third. This was when Walter Alston was still the manager before he took over the manager in 77, so... yeah, I was enthralled. When the Dodgers clinched the pennant in Philadelphia in 1977, I was in the clubhouse. I have pictures of that in the book. I mean, Dusty Baker picked my brother and I up, you know, and hoisted us up like, you know, he was a big uncle, and there was champagne. And I document that very distinctly, how that was burned in my memory and was a huge influence, you know, inspiring me to want to become a major league player.
So you're a great player through high school. You could you played a lot of positions, and then
yeah.
when it didn't get drafted out of high school, you went and did some college ball in Florida. And
mm-hmm.
I mean, people who know your story know the legendary number that you were drafted in the 62nd round
yes.
by the Dodgers. And why did that happen?
I was playing first base and actually swinging the bat pretty well, and I had an injury. I had a torn ligament in my hand, so I missed 3 weeks of the main scouting year, part of the year. When I came back, it was already late. Scouts had already figured out where they wanted to draft, and my dad said, you know, we should try and get Mike drafted because it would help in his college resume for his next school. So eventually Tommy was to convince Ben Wade, who was a scouting director for the Dodgers, to draft me, and... once I was drafted, my dad's like, "Well, why don't see if they want to sign him?" And all the summer went by, and at the end of the summer, they flew me out to L.A. for a tryout, and I played very well, hit the ball, you know, in the seats, and that's at the time when Tommy said he's going to convert to catcher. The story goes that he went to Ben Wade and he said, "Ben, if this kid was a shortstop hitting the balls in the seats like that, would you sign him?" And said, "Yeah, I would." And he said, "Ben, well, if he was a catcher, would you sign him?" And Ben said. Said, "Absolutely." And Tommy said, "Well, he's a catcher." And Ben's like, "No, he's not. He's a first baseman." So at that time, I think as you read, you know, converting to a catcher was a big key in my career.
You played in two of the biggest media markets in the country, and New York, where you were at the Mets, is something one of a kind. How did you figure that out? I mean, you became a semi-regular on the Howard Stern Show, didn't you?
I did. You never figure it out. Oh, it's just definitely take it as it comes, because New York, I've said many times, is it's twice as good when you're winning and twice as bad when you're losing, because it's a very interesting place to play. A lot of players never could do it. I mean, they just couldn't deal with the media. You know, maybe the off-field attractions, maybe just the pressure there. Some guys were happier being in, you know, some of the smaller cities. For me, I always looked at it as a challenge, and I tried to be as accommodating as possible. But I realized that you do have to set limits. And I think New York, in a way, wants you at times to be too available. And I had to sort of pull in the reins and strike a balance between being available and being a personality and letting my personal side out and getting my job done, because I knew that the most important thing on the field was my performance and everything else needed to take a back seat.
One of the more interesting episodes with you in the media was in 2002 when a New York Post gossip columnist wrote a piece suggesting that a big gun on the Mets didn't name you, but said this is somebody who dates models, is actually gay, and is thinking about becoming openly gay. And in no time, your name is attached to this. It's all over talk radio, blogs, and you kind of – people are talking about you as the gay ball player. How did you respond to that?
Well, first off, I try to keep a little bit of a sense of humor about it, only because I think that situation was completely unique unto New York itself. I mean, one week they had me dating a starlet that I'd never met before, and the next week they had me being gay. So I tried to keep it in perspective. I can't really say. You know, the only thing was that I really felt like I had to address it from a team perspective, because it just seemed like it was getting this buzz. I mean, this rumor was gaining some momentum. So I don't want to say I called a press conference. I decided to address it. And then, of course, as in New York, sometimes a non-story is a story. And it just turned into this huge issue, I guess, about, you know, what was going on in that particular issue. But again, I can't explain it. It was just one of those weird things. And it just seems like even though I've had a great career, it just seems like sometimes the situations that are non-orthodox follow me around a little bit, and I just dealt with it as best as I could at the time.
Well, we got to talk about you and Roger Clemens. you know, the aggressive, you know, power pitching right-hander who pitched for a lot of teams, and you really crossed his path when you were at the Mets. He was playing for the Yankees, and there was this day, July of 2000. At Shea, at that point, you had done extremely well against him. In 12 appearances, yes. I think you had 7 hits, 3 of them homers. What happened? You tell us what happened.
Well, yeah. Well, it was kind of interesting. I remember that day because I believe it was the day-night doubleheader. We had actually played at Shea Stadium in the afternoon. And then the second game, because of a rainout, was rescheduled for Yankee Stadium at night. So it was kind of an interesting time because there was like a festival type of atmosphere in New York and very historic. Everyone's talking about day-night doubleheader and one game at Shea and the next game at Yankee Stadium. And I believe Doc Gooden actually beat us, ironically, at Shea Stadium. So the day didn't start out well for us. And, you know, again, I got to the night game in my first at-bat and took a pitch strike, which I usually do in my first at-bat. And the next pitch, obviously, was right at my head and hit me in the helmet. And at the last second, I was able to put my head down and at least not get hit in the face or the eye, which I thought was very dangerous. You know, I got into the clubhouse. You know, obviously was a little woozy. I mean, I suffered a concussion, and then I got into the clubhouse, and the doctor, I should say, was a Yankees doctor, and he was checking me out, and as soon as I got into the clubhouse, he said, well, Roger's on the phone. And I said, basically.
Roger Clemens is calling.
Roger Clemens wanted to call. Yeah.
From the other dugout.
And at that time, I was not in the mood to talk. So I basically told him where to put the phone. And I just was a little perplexed at that because as a doctor, I looked at him. I said, well, you're here to make sure I don't have a hemorrhage or, you know, I'm not going to die or anything. And, you know, he's worried about being the telephone operator. And, you know, after the game, it's funny because, you know, everyone says I called a press conference only because the media was – I mean, you can imagine how many media people were there. And I decided to go to the media room and just basically said I thought he did it on purpose. And that just touched off this drama, I guess, between him and I, you know, for a few years, which just took on a life of its own.
It always struck me that it's one thing for a pitcher to throw at a hitter in retaliation. That's after the other team has thrown at one of their guys. But not that that's mm-hmm. the right thing to do. But when a guy's had success against you, when you've done nothing but do your job and hit the ball,
yeah.
to throw at somebody's head just seems just outside the spirit of the game.
Irrational.
Yeah.
It's true. And you're right. I mean, I think as a pitcher, you know, as well as anybody, that they do have to pitch inside. Pitching on the inside part of the plate is very important. And again, you know, I've been in brawls before where guys got brushed back. But I think, you know, as we've said, that, you know, hitting someone in the head is definitely, I feel, crossing the line and very, very dangerous.
Right. You know? Now, ball players get brushed back from time to time. But what you mm-hmm. saw this ball, the two-seam fastball coming right at your face, it yeah. hits you. You're down, had a concussion. How long did mm-hmm. the memory of that pitch coming at your face remain vivid? Is it still?
Yeah, I still see it now, believe it or not. It's one of those things that's just seared in your memory. You just never forget it. I mean, I'm blessed and lucky that obviously that, you know, I was able to at least get the helmet on it. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those things too, where you can take a 300-pound lineman football player and a real tough guy and then put him in a cage and have the ball come at him and he looks like, you know, a little girl, you know? So it's, one of those things as a hitter. It's kind of like, I guess, a race car driver. You really can't be conscious of getting into an accident because you will not be able to perform. So as a hitter, you never, and even after that, I mean, you can't let it creep in your psyche because you will not be able to do your job.
Was it hard getting back? It must have been hard getting back in the first time against big league pitching after that.
I would say it was. It definitely was. And, you know, I think my first at bat was actually against Pedro Martinez, who was another guy who wasn't afraid to give you a shave. So you do have to discipline yourself and use every amount of your focus to block it out and get back on track because this game is not for the weak. You cannot allow yourself to have anxiety up there. It will not work.
Right, and you managed mm-hmm. to continue hitting, playing well. And mm-hmm. so that's in July of 2000. And then mm-hmm. as the plot would unfold in October, yeah. your team meets the Yankees in the World Series. There you mm-hmm. are. For people that don't remember the incident, what happens was it's, I think, a two-strike pitch. You swing, yeah. and your bat shatters in two. The ball, mm-hmm. you start down the first baseline because you're not sure where the ball
that's
is.
Correct.
And then it turns out the barrel of the bat with a sharp end on it ends up next yeah. to Clemens on the mound. He picks it up and flings it.
He actually caught it, believe it or not. Yeah.
In the air? Wow.
Like on a hop.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then flings it in your direction. And then his explanation to you and the umpire is, I thought it was the ball.
Yeah. Still, I mean, you know, I think back and people today still yeah. ask me, what were you thinking? And I said, I don't know. What was he thinking? Why didn't you ask him? He thought it was the ball. And Charlie Relliford, who was the umpire at the time, I believe, when it came up to me, and I said, Charlie, what the explicative is he talking about? He goes, I don't know. Let's play ball. And then all the other players came out, and then there was a little bit of a scrum, I guess, and it just never developed in anything. But a lot of shouting. I mean, guys from the Yankees were telling me to get back in the box, and it just was, again, one of the most bizarre things. I've kind of surrendered to the fact that, you know, this is one of the most, you know, one of the highlights, I guess, for lack of a better word, of my career. And I just had to surrender and embrace the fact that people want to know about it. So I told them verbatim what I was thinking at the time.
Now, you and Clemens have been around each other since then, I know, and
yes.
have had cordial words, I suppose. But
yeah.
I do want to read your description in your book. Right after you describe when he beamed you at that time in July and gave you the concussion, you write, mm-hmm. Roger Clemens has near-perfect control. I wouldn't have batted an eye if he'd just brushed me off the plate. Of course, mm-hmm. that's what he said he was trying to do. and I wouldn't have thought twice about it if he'd put a ball in my ribs, but to stick one in my forehead, that's another story. Clemens had always come across to me as the playground bully, huffing and puffing and snorting and yelling at batters, doing whatever he could to intimidate them. Sounds to me like you have a pretty firm opinion of him as a player.
Which some words need to be kept fry. But no, and, you know, I've said many times, you know, as a player, you do have to admire at least competitive guys. I mean, I've always felt like in my career I've always wanted to face the best pitchers, the closers, the guys that were, you know, the intimidators, or so to speak. So I never shied away, and as you could tell by my stats, I always had pretty good at-bats against him as well. But I mean, you know, to me, it just seemed like he was very frustrated with my success. And as I've said before, you know, I basically said that I thought he did obviously hit me intentionally, which, as you mentioned, was one of those unbroken rules, I guess, that maybe I broke from the old school guys, that you shouldn't have said that. But I was very sensitive to it at the time, and understandably so. It was a very dangerous thing to do.
You finished the game in 2007, and I've always wondered, what's it like to go to the ballpark when you've left the big leagues? I mean, before you would go every day. You had a parking place up front. You knew everybody. You were in the middle of it. What's it like to go and be in the stands or in a box?
Back to the career coming to an end, it is like a small death, I guess, in a way. And I've, you know, kind of talked about that in the book, where I saw myself at the end of my career, that fire going out. And it's a little depressing. I mean, you know, my wife always laughed, because when I was home for the first year, she was like thinking this should be a celebration. We should be drinking champagne and, you know, toasting a great career. But I was somewhat depressed. I mean, I wouldn't say clinically, but I mean, it's tough, because it's the only thing you've ever known as an adult. It's the only thing I've ever done. It gives you purpose. It gives you a sense of contribution, and then it's gone. And so, yeah, it was a little painful. I mean, I stayed away from the game for about 2 or 3 years, where I really didn't go to a game. I watched very little, just the playoffs. And I needed to internalize those feelings and sort of start a new chapter in my life. You know, now I'm coaching a little bit, you know, with the Italian program, and realize that I feel like I can get back to the game, but it has to be at a pace which, you know, I have a passion for, you know.
Mike Piazza's new memoir is called Long Shot. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.